Allora, io ho solo il compito di introdurre i nostri speaker di oggi e il primo, lo vedete, sta seduto a mia sinistra, il professor Peter McNaughton, che viene dall'Università di Cambridge, ma è di origini nuovo-zelandesi, ha compiuto i suoi studi in Nuova Zelanda e subito dopo la high school si è trasferito in Inghilterra, dove è stato Rhodes Scholar a Oxford e qui mi ha segnato questo appunto come Bill Clinton. Non ho capito bene se era lo stesso periodo o no, lo stesso periodo.
Un po' dopo.
Un po' dopo. In realtà Peter parla l'italiano, quindi attenzione, perché anche se farà la sua presentazione in inglese. Io ho conosciuto Peter subito dopo, nel 1976, quando lui era andato a Cambridge e lavorava come postdoc nel Dipartimento di Fisiologia. Ci siamo conosciuti lì, siamo rimasti amici fino ad ora e spero anche oltre. È stato così gentile di venire qui a parlarci dei suoi argomenti, degli argomenti di cui si è occupato per tutta la sua carriera, non di tutti in realtà, perché naturalmente si è fatta una carriera molto lunga che è cominciata con studi sulla fotorecezione, lavorando a Cambridge con il professor Alan Hodgkin, che sentite nominare sempre nei corsi di fisiologia di base, è quello che insieme ad Arx naturalmente ha rivelato il meccanismo del potenziale d'azione. Ma appunto intorno agli anni 70 Hodgkin a Cambridge si occupava di fotorecezione e Peter ha cominciato lì la sua avventura nel campo della fisiologia sensoriale. Poi si è trasferito a Londra come capo del Dipartimento di Fisiologia del King's College, questo negli anni 90, è rimasto 7-8 anni a Londra e poi è ritornato a Cambridge come direttore del Dipartimento di Farmacologia. E sia a King's College che a Cambridge il suo interesse si è spostato più sulla nocicezione, un campo della fisiologia sensoriale che è di grande interesse non solo culturale ma anche pratico naturalmente. E credo di essermi dilungato anche troppo, lascio la parola a Peter. Grazie Peter. Ci farà adesso un'introduzione diciamo sui sistemi sensoriali e poi oggi pomeriggio come ultima lezione invece ci parlerà dell'argomento di ricerca attuale che è quello della nocicezione.
Ok, grazie mille Antonio. Lo sento, ma non parlo molto bene italiano. Parlo un po', qualche parola, ma non sufficiente per presentare la mia presentazione in italiano. E per questo parlerò in inglese. È meno difficile per me e meno dolore per voi. Okay, I will speak slowly. If you don't understand, please hands up and I can always slow down. Now, Antonio, I have 1 hour, yes?
Yeah, I mean, not very so strict.
Not so strict. Okay.
Longer.
Antonio, do you have a laser pointer?
I have a laser. I have a laser pointer.
I'm sorry. Okay. Usare il mouse. Okay. Perfetto. Okay. Antonio asked me to give one lecture on general introduction to sensory mechanisms. Now, so what I'm going to do is to provide an overall view of how we detect external stimuli. And the principles that I'm going to talk about will be applicable more generally to the specific sensory systems that you will hear about later. So what I'm going to say for this first lecture is really rather elementary, but these, and I'm sure that you know most of these things already, but these are general principles that I hope you will bear in mind for the other sensory systems that we will do later on. So first, to talk about the historic view of sensory systems. Now, this is a classic picture of how sensations occurred, but actually it dates from Descartes, from 350 years ago. But I think it's a remarkable and very powerful hypothesis, because it was a hypothesis in those days, and it's also largely correct. You can see that Descartes, in this picture in 1644, says that if, for example, the fire A, as if we didn't know what the fire was, comes near the foot B, the minute particles of this fire, he says, which, as you know, move with great velocity. Now, I think we have to remember that this is 350 years ago, and it's all perfectly correct. The minute particles of this fire, he knows there are particles in the fire, he knows that they move with great velocity, and he says if these particles come near this foot, the particles have the power to set in motion the spot of the skin of the foot which they touch. Well, now we understand this in molecular terms about what happens, and I'll talk about that later. But still, this is a remarkably correct description of what happens there. But now, unfortunately, we go off track a little bit. And by this means, pulling on the delicate thread. This is the delicate thread, the nerve fibre. Thank you, Antonio. Thank you. Thank you very much. Pulling on the thread. Here he has in mind a mechanical model where the nerve fibre actually acts as a thread connecting up to the central nervous system, which of course is not correct, but this is 350 years ago. And then we go off track a little bit. They open up at the same instant the pore. He has in mind a pore up here in the brain against which the delicate thread ends. Just as by pulling against one end of a rope, one makes to strike at the same instant a bell which hangs at the other end. It's fundamentally correct, but of course in the details at the end it's not correct. And I think this is probably conditioned by the sort of environment that Descartes grew up in which an aristocratic person in France would summon a servant from a distant kitchen by pulling on a rope which was connected by a series of levers and pulleys to some distant location. And he has in mind this is an analogy of the brain. Well, as another general introductory slide, I just wanted to mention Galvani, of course, one of the great fathers of modern, probably the great father of modern electrophysiology. This is not directly relevant to sensation, but I just wanted to talk a little bit about the role of chance in science. Here we have a picture of an early experiment of Galvani's, and what he was trying to do was to imitate the work of Benjamin Franklin. You remember that Benjamin Franklin got a small boy to fly a kite in a thunderstorm, and he himself held onto the kite string, and when the lightning flashed, he was able to feel a tingling which told him that electricity was involved in lightning. An extremely dangerous experiment, I have to say. Do not try this at home, children. I should mention that a highly methodical German scientist decided to repeat Franklin's experiment. He did it in a much better way. He stood up in a church tower, and he held onto a copper rod which projected out through the top of the tower, and he himself stood on an earthed copper plate which went down to the earth, and he stood between the two of them until the lightning flashed, I have to say, with predictable responses. He was immediately electrocuted. This experiment, Galvani was trying to repeat this experiment as well, but he found something much more important. There is his connection up here, which was hoping to detect a lightning flash, and he was hoping to show that lightning, the electricity of lightning, could stimulate a frog's legs that he was studying. The theory, of course, was that electricity activated nervous and muscular contraction. But actually, he did this experiment on a fine day. Well, maybe it wasn't fine, but there wasn't enough lightning. And he got a little bit bored. So he was rearranging the frog's legs with some forceps that he had, which happened to be of two different metals. One was constructed of steel and one of bronze. And he found that when the two forceps connected together like that, that the frog's legs contracted. So he had discovered, of course, the galvanic pile, the battery, and from there the story goes on. I think what one would have to attribute Galvani with was great powers of observation and also the ability to think outside what he was doing at that precise moment. He was trying to show that lightning stimulated contraction of a frog's muscle, but in fact he found something quite different, and from that he invented the battery, the galvanic pile. Well, now back to the theme of what we're talking about. I'm going to talk about two rather different sensory systems, two that I know very well as I've worked on both of them, as Antonio said at the start. Vision, and what I work on now, I work specifically on pain, but I'm going to talk more generally about somatic sensation. So these are quite different senses, but they have much the same task to perform, much the same job. And they accomplish it in quite different ways, as we will see, but the strategies that they have to use in order to do this are in principle the same. In the details of implementation, they are actually quite different. So the first thing that receptors have to do is they have to tell us about specific events in the outside world. There's no sense in a flash of light being just interpreted in some quite general sense, as a primitive organism might do. We need to know not only that it's light, we need to know about its intensity. Is it bright? Is it dim? We need to know about its colour. We need to know about its location. We need to know many things. Is this a flash of light which is caused by the sun rising? Or is it maybe a light which detects the fact that a lion is coming over the horizon? We need to know the difference between the lion and the sun. One is welcoming, the other, of course, if we don't do something quite quick about it, it will mean our imminent death. So receptors are specialized to detect particular sensory modalities and, of course, also stimulus intensities. And how do they do this? Well, rods and cones, of course, as you know, are specialized. The rods are specialized to detect very weak lights, very dim lights. Cones are specialized to detect brighter lights, but they do so with much better time resolution. So rods react slowly but with high sensitivity. Cones respond much more rapidly but with much lower sensitivity. And we can see this in the picture at the left here. Here is the rod. Of course, the light-sensitive apparatus is here in the outer segment, and the inner segment contains the neural apparatus for communicating with second-order neurons. Now, in darkness, there is an inward current flowing into the rod. So all the time you have an inward current flowing here, it circulates. It goes around like this all the time. And a bright flash of light closes all of the channels in the outer segment. You can see that happening here. The current closes up to a level of zero up here. And the fact that there's no longer an inward current, of course, means that the membrane potential becomes more negative, as we can see down here. The membrane potential becomes more negative. but the point I want to make about this picture is that basically the same thing happens in cones, but it happens much more quickly. So cones react much more quickly. This corresponds, of course, to the fact that our visual systems are much quicker in bright light than they are in dim light. Dim light is dangerous for us because our visual system reacts slowly, therefore we're much less good at escaping predators. Fortunately, the same thing applies to the predators as well. Their visual system also responds more slowly in darkness, and therefore the stakes are a little bit more even. So this picture makes the point that the voltage inside the photoreceptor hyperpolarizes in response to light, and that the speed of reaction to both dim lights and to bright lights is much slower for rods than it is for cones. Now, the picture across to the right here makes the point that rods are much more sensitive than cones, because what we've plotted here is the peak response in response to an increasing series of light flashes. And rods, of course, respond at much lower levels of intensity. The intensity is here along the axis, at much lower levels of intensity than cones, which respond to much brighter lights. So we've animals deal with the fact that light is present in a huge range of intensities by dividing this up into two. They have receptors for dim lights and they have receptors for bright lights. This enables us to operate over a very wide range of intensities. Now, of course, as is well known, it's basic things, of course, but I did want to emphasize how important these things are. As is well known, of course, cones come in a variety of colors. They use the same basic principles, as I'll show you in a moment, but the fact that you have different visual pigments, this example is in the goldfish, means that you are able to detect different colors of light, different wavelengths, and to have color vision. And practically all animals have color vision of some sort. Goldfish actually have much better color vision than we do. They're tetrachromatic. They have four pigments, one that goes right down to the ultraviolet, and they have three pigments which are present in the visual range that's covered by our visual pigments. We have one in the blue here, and our green and our red are actually quite a bit closer than that. So one would have to say that we actually have rather poorer vision than goldfish. Humans in general don't have a very high opinion of the intelligence of goldfish. Sometimes people talking about, well, when I talk to my daughter, I sometimes say that she has the concentration span of a goldfish. But it would have to be admitted that goldfish have very much better color vision than we humans do. Well, let's have a look at the somatosensory system. Here we have a quite different task. You have to detect stimuli which impinge on the skin surface. Now, we tend to think of this as the sense of touch. You touch something, that's touch, end of story. This is what Aristotle said. He said you had the five senses. Of course, they are vision, hearing, olfaction, gustation, and touch. Touch, end of story. But in fact, touch is many different senses, as we will see here. And there are, well, many, many different types of sensory receptors, but they're traditionally classified into five different sorts. In smooth skin, which is called glabrous skin, we have four main receptors which are concerned with mechanical touch, with light touch. There are two which are located very near the skin surface, and this one here is called Meissner's corpuscle, and this one here is called Merkel's disc. And because they're very close to the skin surface here, these receptors are very good at distinguishing fine features of objects they touch. They have very good spatial discrimination, as I'll show you in just a moment. But as well, we have two deep receptors, one called the Pacinian corpuscle, which is really specialized for detecting vibrations. So if you put your hand on an engine which is running at 300 cycles per second, it's your Pacinian corpuscles which are detecting that vibration. And then we have a deep ending here called Ruffini's ending. This responds mainly to deep pressure, pressure which affects the muscles deep inside the skin. So in addition to these four endings, which all have specialized roles in detecting mechanical changes of one sort or another, we also have three nerve endings. And these actually are not a single type of receptor. They cover a huge range. they detect temperature, warmth, cold, pain, heat, whole range of different things. It's just that histologically they look all rather similar. And then finally in hairy skin, we have these hair follicle receptors which loop around the base of the hair cell and are particularly concerned with responding to light touch, which causes the hairs to bend. So once again, the picture is very complex. We have a very wide range of receptors here which carry out a variety of tasks. How do we know this? Well, what these receptors do was discovered more than 100 years ago in some wonderful experiments carried out by von Frey. Wonderful, but I would have to say slightly gruesome experiments. The 19th century histologists had already characterized these receptors. Each one gave them his own name. We can see here that they were mostly Germans, as you can see. We have Merkel, we have Meissner, we have Pacini, we have Ruffini. They had characterized them from a histological point of view, but what did these receptors actually do? Well, the experiment that von Frey did was to use the skin of the back, where these receptors are rather widely separated, and he touched specific spots, and he could find spots which corresponded to a particular receptor, a spot which responded, say, to vibration particularly, or maybe to warmth or to cold. He could find particular spots. And then, I don't know who his subjects were, but they must have been very agreeable people. He would then cut out a little spot and perform the histology and find out what sort of receptor was present in that particular spot. I suppose they were only little spots, but still, he must have paid them a lot of money, or else maybe they were members of his own family, I don't know. But anyway, so what he discovered essentially was that that these different kinds of receptors, these ones all corresponded to mechanical receptors, whereas if he found a cold spot or a warm spot or a pain spot, those always corresponded to free nerve endings. So I just wanted to show you a little bit more about the types of stimuli that these skin surface receptors respond to. Here we have two which respond to vibration. You'll remember that Meissner's corpuscle is rather superficial. It's this one here. Whereas Pacinian corpuscle is also a vibration detector, but is rather deep. So these are two vibration detectors, but they respond to different frequencies. Pacinian corpuscles are very good vibration detectors of high frequency vibration. That sort of frequency. They respond optimally. Whereas Meissner's corpuscles respond optimally to much lower frequency, sort of the vibration of mains frequency. But they are both vibration detectors. Here we have receptors for warmth and cold, and once again here we're looking at the firing frequency as a function of temperature. And you can see that we have receptors which respond best to cold stimuli. I wouldn't say very cold, rather cool stimuli. Stimuli that are around about 25 degrees centigrade. And we also have receptors which respond best to warm stimuli, just within the pleasant range of warmth, up to about 40 degrees centigrade. Now, we now know a great deal more about this, and I will show you a picture which summarizes this in just a moment, but we know now that there are receptors also for more extreme cold down here, which corresponds to painful cold. There are also a whole clutch of receptors up here which respond to more extreme heat. These are receptors for painful heat. And in fact, in the English language, and I think also in Italian as well, we have different words to describe these. We talk about cold. Cold is an unpleasant stimulus. It's a painful cold. Then we talk about cool. Cool is you know, we talk about people being mega cool. He's, as my children would say, he's cool man. You know, cool has got a good feeling about it, whereas cold is an unpleasant sensation. And in fact, there are different molecular receptors for these. I don't think cold is a very good word for this. This actually is the cool receptor. This is pleasant coolness. Warm, of course, has a pleasant feeling about it, whereas hot means also a high temperature, but it's unpleasantly hot, painfully hot. And in fact, we know now that there are many more receptors than these. There is cool, there is warm, and there is hot. Basically, these four receptors, there are a couple of extra ones, I shouldn't push this analogy too far, but these four main modalities of temperature sensation correspond now, we know, to four different cloned molecular entities, which are all members of the TRIP family. I'll talk about this in my second lecture today. They've been cloned, and we know quite a lot about their properties. Well, the difference between these two receptors that I mentioned a moment ago, these two mechanical receptors, extends also to their receptive fields. And once again, these are rather heroic experiments, the sorts of experiments that people don't often do nowadays, where you test the receptive field, you record from a single nerve fiber, you look at how many action potentials are produced in response to a particular stimulus. And they found that myosinous corpuscles have extremely small receptive fields, whereas Pacinian corpuscles have very large receptive fields. Now, I think this corresponds with the histology of these receptors. Myosinous corpuscles are located very superficially, so of course they detect stimuli only in the immediate environment, whereas Pacinian corpuscles, you'll remember, are located quite deep. The stimulus has to travel quite a long way to reach them, and therefore they detect over a very wide area. Does this mean that one is better than the other? No, what it means is that each is adapted to a particular task, to a particular different sensory task. And we could see this here. Here we have a particular task that we are carrying out. This is detection of braille dots. So this is really corresponds to detecting very small stimuli, very small discrete dots with very high resolution. Now, which receptors do you use to do this particular task? Well, they did this with a monkey. They recorded from nerve fibers that projected to particular receptors. They were able to identify the receptors from a knowledge of the properties of these nerve fibers. And they passed a drum which contains a variety of braille dots. They passed this over the finger of the monkey and looked to see how these different receptors responded. Now, you remember we have these two rapidly adapting receptors, myosinous corpuscle and Pacinian corpuscle, and then a superficial receptor called Merkel's disc, which is slowly adapting. Now, by passing this drum over the finger many times, they've carried out the same task that we would do if we scanned over those dots with our finger. But instead of recording from, of course, what we would do is we would feel all five dots simultaneously here. We would feel them all at once, we would detect them all together. They are recording from a single receptor, so what they've had to do is pass all the dots over the receptor and then move the stimulus down so as to scan across the whole field. And they were able to build up, each action potential here is represented as a point, and therefore you can build up a picture of how that particular receptor was responding to those dots. And I think you could see that Merkel's receptors, the superficial, slowly adapting receptors, give a pretty faithful record of the appearance of the dots. Myosinous corpuscles give some sort of picture of dots, of course. Pacinian corpuscles, however, give really an extremely poor picture in spatial terms of what the dots look like. And I think this corresponds to what I showed you a moment ago. Pacinian corpuscles have very large receptive fields. Myosinous corpuscles are small. Merkel's disc receptive fields are even smaller. So for this particular task, detecting finely structured dots on a surface, obviously we are using Merkel's receptors here. Does this mean that the other ones are no good, that these receptors here are useless? Well, no, of course not. it simply means that these receptors are used for different tasks, for simian corpuscles, for detecting vibration, for instance, but at very poor spatial resolution, a completely different task for which these receptors are specialized. Well, that finishes what I want to say about how our receptors are specialized for particular tasks, which corresponds, of course, to particular features of the environment that we want to distinguish. How do they do it? Well, all receptors, without exception, all receptors have to transduce. This word comes originally from the Latin. I'm not sure if the word exists in Italian, but it means to carry over from one place or to draw across from one place to another. And what we're doing is transducing energy. The energy has to be transduced from what it was originally, light, mechanical energy or whatever. It has to be transduced into a different form of energy, which is always the same. It has to be transduced into an electrical signal, because electrical signals are the universal currency of the nervous system that we use for all communications between nerve cells, action potentials. Everything is electrical in the nervous system. So this process of transduction works differently in different sensory receptors. So first of all, what we have to do is to detect the incoming energy, whether it's photons of light or whether it's a stimulus impinging on the skin. So how do we detect this? Well, of course, very differently in different sensory systems. Let's begin with vision, the first sensory system that I want to talk about. Now, vision always uses this same molecule here, which is retinal. Now, irrespective of whether it's present in rods, cones, it's always retinal, always the same molecule. And of course, in darkness, retinal is in the bent form here, where we have a cis bond here at this 11-12 point here. There's a cis bond. And what light does is provide energy to straighten out this molecule, to bend it into the trans form here, to make it straight. Now, the way it does this is that this molecule, with its alternating single and double bonds, has electrons which are to a large extent delocalized along the length of this chain. So you can think of this molecule here as being rather like one of these television antennas which picks up a signal. The television antenna with its crossbars like this. This is about the wavelength of the incoming signal, the television signal. It's adapted, it's got that particular length, because this absorbs the incoming signal well. Well, we have a similar system here, really. Of course, the television aerial is made of metal. It's got electrons which can oscillate in response to the incoming signal. Here we have a rather similar system, electrons which are delocalized here and which can oscillate in response to an incoming light signal. I shouldn't pursue this sort of wavelength analogy too far. In fact, this molecule is very much shorter than the wavelength of light, but the preferred oscillatory frequency of the electrons is equal to the wavelength of light which is best detected. So the incoming light preferentially excites the electrons at a particular frequency, because this is the frequency of the incoming light, and the electrons in this chain resonate with this frequency. Of course, we get different frequencies of light. We detect different frequencies by changing the resonant frequency of these electrons. This is done not by this molecule itself, it's always the same molecule, but by the environment which exists around it. If you put a negative charge very close, then that changes the frequency of oscillation, and it means you detect a different frequency of light. So when light of the appropriate frequency excites these electrons, this provides enough energy to isomerize this bond, twist it around, and change the shape of the molecule. And this, of course, is the first event in vision. Now, here you can see the second event, which is a change in the conformation of the rhodopsin molecule. because, of course, retinal, here we see it here, is embedded in this molecule, which is a 7 transmembrane receptor, a G protein coupled receptor. Of course, such receptors are very well known throughout biology. They're almost ubiquitous means of signaling. Here, of course, generally these receptors, of course, are hormone detectors. Here, of course, the hormone is not a chemical hormone. The hormone is light. But I think the fact that a G protein coupled receptor is used to detect light probably has its origin in the fact that light is like a hormone for a primitive animal. A primitive animal with no vision still needs to know whether it's dark or light, because their behavior will change according to whether it's dark or light. So when it's light, they would have detected light without an imaging system at all, just to know that it's light rather than dark, and this would have changed their behavior. So light originally was very much like a hormone. Of course, now these same receptors are part of an imaging system which tell us about spatial events of things around us, but we're much more sophisticated than those primitive animals. So here we have rhodopsin with retinal buried right in the heart here. By the way, lots of hormone receptors work like this as well. We tend to think of hormones as something which comes from the outside and sticks to the outside of the receptor. But often that's not true. Many hormones, such as adrenaline interacting with the beta-adrenergic receptor, in fact binds to a site which is very deep within the molecule and which is in a position rather similar to this. So there's the retinal molecule. Appropriately, it's right in the heart of the molecule. And in fact, if we look down from above, we see this picture here. These are the helices here, seen from above. And here is the retinal molecule in its bent form here. And when it straightens out, you can see that it moves around to this form here, the all trans form. It's like an elephant in the middle of this molecule. It changes its conformation and just bursts the molecule open like that. So by changing its conformation, it splays out these helices. These helices get spread out like that. And as a result, the conformation at the intracellular surface, the conformation at this side here, changes, which leads, of course, to the events which happen downstream, which I'll talk about in just a moment. So this is the extracellular face, but of course these rhodopsin molecules are located in discs. So actually, when it says extracellular, that corresponds to the space inside the disc. And where it says intracellular here, that corresponds to the place in the to the inside of the cell or to the cytoplasm. So it's right here that the conformational changes are important. Probably there are changes here as well, but that doesn't matter at all. The important thing is that there are changes at this point here as these helices are spread open and therefore other molecules, G proteins, can bind at this point. Well, these G proteins are important in the amplification steps which follow on afterwards. And that's what I'd like to look at next. Here, of course, we're dealing with a very minute quantity of energy, a single photon of light, an almost unbelievably small quantity of energy. In order to make this into a nervous signal, we need to have some sort of amplification. Particularly for rod vision, which is very, very sensitive, we need a very large degree of amplification. And how it works, I'm sure it's well known to you, but I'll just go over it quickly. How it works is shown here. Here we have, there's the surface membrane of the rod, or in fact it applies also to cones, but most of the work's been done on rods. And these are the discs within the rod here. There is the rhodopsin molecule sitting exactly as I described before. And in response to a photon of light, we have this conformational change at this point here. And the conformational change allows a G protein to bind. So somehow, not very well understood, somehow in its unactivated form, the G protein is unable to bind. When it's activated, like a sort of flower opening, the G protein is unable to bind and to be activated. Now, of course, what happens, as is well known, is that binding here causes the G protein to dissociate into its alpha and beta gamma subunits. So that's point one. The second point, of course, is that the G protein undergoes a GDP-GTP exchange. So actually this is the primary event. This exchange here causes the dissociation of these two inhibitory molecules, the beta and gamma subunits. So when you have a photon of light, R star is normally the symbol used to describe activated rhodopsin. R star binds the G protein, which causes GDP-GTP exchange and releases the G-alpha subunit. The G-alpha subunit, of course, is what performs downstream tasks. But the important point here is that each activated rhodopsin can perform this task over and over again. So it's not once, it happens many times. Probably 100 or more times a G-protein can be activated by a rhodopsin. So it's like a child's game of tag. You know, one child, we say in English, one child is it, and that child has to go around and it has to touch the other ones, and they all become it in turn. So each child, each activated rhodopsin molecule, can go around tagging about 100 other G-proteins who are all in turn activated before the rhodopsin molecule is actually switched off. So you can see at this first stage, we have a high degree of amplification, and that's very important for all sensory systems. The G protein then, of course, interacts with a phosphodiesterase molecule, which is shown here. The phosphodiesterase breaks down cyclic GMP. So what happens in darkness is that cyclic GMP levels are high. Cyclic GMP is bound to these channels, which are specialized channels, which are cyclic nucleotide gated channels. They're like ion channels which are gated by an internal hormone rather than an external hormone. They're gated by cyclic GMP rather than by adrenaline or something like that. So in darkness, these channels are open and a high degree of ionic current is flowing into the cell. In light, cyclic GMP is metabolized. I'm sorry, it goes that way. Cyclic GMP is metabolized to GMP, so in the absence of cyclic GMP, these channels close. So this is exactly the process that I showed you a moment ago when we were looking at it. I was further back than I thought. This is the process here. Channels are open in the darkness, and they are, of course, closed in light. So amplification steps, well, I've already talked about the first stage of amplification. There isn't much amplification here. Each G protein binds to a single phosphodiesterase, but of course there's a lot of amplification here. Each phosphodiesterase can metabolize many, many molecules of cyclic GMP, so you have amplification here. And then finally, of course, there's amplification here. Closing a single channel shuts off the passage of hundreds or thousands of sodium ions. So at the bottom here, each absorbed photon obstructs the passage of about a million sodium ions in a dark-adapted rod. So a very high degree of amplification indeed. I think I've chosen a particular example here where the degree of amplification is particularly high. In many other cases, it's much less. Cones, it's very much less than this. In many tactile receptors, as I'll show in a moment, it's also much less. But still, the principle of amplification is almost universally true in sensory receptors. Well, this part I've already talked about. In darkness, of course, we have this circulating dark current here, and in light, the channels here are closed, the dark current is shut off, and therefore the voltage in the inner segment is hyperpolarized to a more negative level, and the result, of course, is that transmitter release from the terminal here to the second order cells is shut off, and of course that's the primary event in vision. Now there are all sorts of exciting things happen after that, but I won't talk about those anymore. I just wanted to focus on the receptors themselves. Well, somatosensory receptors, here we have a quite different picture. The same objectives in terms of tasks that have to be carried out, but the details by which they're accomplished are quite different. Now, here, for somatosensory receptors, we have a difference, which is that these are what you might call short receptors. They can communicate from one end to the other very easily because they're very small. So a change in current here causes a change in voltage here, and that effect is propagated very easily to the synaptic terminal because the overall length of the photoreceptor is only about 100 microns. But when you're talking about touch receptors of course are very far away from the detector, which is up here somewhere, well, actually up about here. So we have to communicate over a very long distance. In order to do this, we must have action potentials. In order to have action potentials, we must have depolarization. So in somatosensory receptors, there must be a depolarization, a positive receptor potential in response to the stimulus. And the way this is often carried out, normally carried out, the example is shown here for pressure. Pressure opens mechanically sensitive ion channels. So the ion channels are opened, where of course in photoreceptors they're closed. So the ion channels are opened, sodium ions flow in, make the internal receptor potential more positive. Then the second event takes place, which is an action potential is initiated, which then propagates up to the central nervous system. Well, I've already mentioned that there are many different types of these ion channels. I don't want to spend too long on this, but this shows all of the ion channels that are used in the sensation of pain. And really, there are a lot of them. There are ion channels that respond to heat, and I'll talk more about this ion channel in my lecture this afternoon. Ion channels that respond to heat. Well, actually, there's another one here that's also thought to respond to heat. The receptor for cold we see here. There are receptors for acid. These are called acid-sensitive ion channels, or ASICs. Acid, of course, is a very important signal for pain, metabolic overload. Acid is produced by metabolic stress. Then we have receptors for ATP. ATP, of course, is a very good signal for pain because ATP is released from damaged cells. When a cell is burst, ATP floods out. We want to be able to detect that. The only thing we don't know very much about are receptors for mechanical stimuli. So actually, the most obvious thing when you talk about somatosensation is mechanical stimuli of one sort or another, as I've shown here. But the identity of these ion channels is still rather mysterious. But we know quite a lot about other ones. And then I've shown here the sodium channels, which lead to the production of an action potential. And once again, there are a whole variety of these different sodium channels. So that's the first step of detecting a sensory stimulus and converting it into an electrical signal. But the other important property of sensory receptors that I want to talk about is the property of adaptation. Now, adaptation is very important in enabling you to take your receptors into a wide variety of environments. So if we're in a dark environment here and we go outside, the light level might increase by maybe 10 million fold or something like that, a huge increase in light level. We have to have some way of adapting to that. And so adaptation, which is the process by which the amplification is reduced when you go from a low light level to a high light level, or from a low touch level to a high touch level, every sensory system works the same. The process of adaptation is absolutely vital for enabling us to change between different environments. Of course, we have no control over the environment. We can control the environment within our body, but we can't control what's outside. Our sensory system just has to be able to adapt itself to enable us to go between different stimulus levels. So this is an extremely important property of all sensory systems. And once again, they all have to adapt, but they do it in many different ways. Now, first of all, I'd like to talk about vision. The system for adapting to vision really has a lot in common with the system by which the chain is turned off. So we've initiated the chain. This is the part of the diagram that I showed you before. We've initiated the chain, we've activated our G protein, we've activated our phosphodiesterase, and we've closed off our ionic channels here in the surface membrane. But now we have to switch it all off. And the way I'll go over the way in which it's switched off, and then I'll talk about how that relates to adaptation. So switching it off is a rather complex process, because each step in the chain has to be switched off. There's no point in just switching off the rhodopsin and still leaving the G proteins active. That won't do anything. Equally, we could switch off the G proteins, but the rhodopsin could still be activating more of them. So each step in the chain has to be switched off. So how is the rhodopsin switched off to start off with? Well, this is a rather complex procedure. It's actually common to all G protein coupled receptors, beta receptors, muscarinic receptors, etc. They all work in basically the same way. But it was discovered first, I have to say, in photoreceptors. And the way it works is that there's a specific kinase called a rhodopsin kinase whose only job is to phosphorylate this particular protein molecule. The rhodopsin kinase tacks actually a whole range of phosphates on the N-terminal, the C-terminal of the rhodopsin here. So there are the phosphates. And when the protein has been phosphorylated, this is then a signal for the binding of a sort of cap molecule, which shuts off the rhodopsin. And this cap molecule is called arrestin. So arrestin arrests the ability of rhodopsin to activate any more G proteins. So once the molecule's been capped off by arrestin, no more G proteins can be inactivated. So that's the first step, shut off. How is the G protein shut off? Well, the G protein is shut off basically by metabolizing its GTP to GDP. So once it's metabolized that to GDP, then it shuts off and returns to its basic level. This seemed to be pretty obvious a few years ago, but then it was discovered that actually this process is very slow. It takes about 100 seconds or more to metabolize GTP to GDP. So clearly something else is going on. And in fact, it's now well known that all G proteins have proteins which bind to them, which accelerate this process of metabolism. So the process actually depends on two factors. Firstly, on metabolizing GTP, but secondly, on this process of metabolism is only initiated by binding to other molecules which speed up the metabolism process. So you can see these molecules here. These are molecules which there's actually a quite complex series of molecules which speed up this process, but one of them is actually phosphodiesterase itself. So just binding to phosphodiesterase is enough to speed up this metabolism process. So, sort of to cut a long story short, as we might say, once the GTP is metabolized to GDP, then of course it separates from the phosphodiesterase, and the phosphodiesterase, in the absence of the G protein, just switches off. So the phosphodiesterase depends absolutely on having the G-alpha subunit bound to it in order to be active. And then, of course, the G-alpha subunit combines with the beta-gamma and everything returns to normal. Well, then one step, a very important step, which is actually not shown here, is that in order to open these channels again, we need to resynthesize GTP to cyclic GMP. So this guanylate cyclase enzyme needs to restore the cyclic GMP levels. Now, that may seem rather simple, but I think this is probably the key to light adaptation here. Because calcium ions coming in, calcium ions inhibit this process. So normally, of course, in darkness, calcium ions are flooding into the cell. When light closes these channels, so we've, if you like, moved from a dim environment into a bright environment, so these channels are closed off, then the calcium level inside the photoreceptors declines. And this is something that my own group showed, golly, it must be 20 years ago now. We were very excited when we found this, because the decline in calcium levels actually turned out to be the key to light adaptation. And the reason is that this enzyme here is calcium sensitive. So when calcium declines, this enzyme produces more cyclic GMP. So we have a sort of feedback process here. The channels go from open to closed, but then cyclic GMP is produced again, and the channels open again. So this explains, you go from a dark environment to a bright environment. At first you're dazzled, and this is because all of your channels have been closed. Your channels are closed, calcium levels drop, therefore cyclic GMP is produced again by this guanylate cyclase enzyme, and therefore the channels start to open once again. So that the cyclic GMP drops and then recovers, and this recovery is calcium mediated. So in the recovered state, once it's recovered, everything is working faster because all these processes in this chain have been speeded up, and also the production of cyclic GMP has speeded up. So in the light adapted state, your photoreceptors are operating much more rapidly. So this corresponds to a very well-known observation many, many years ago, that vision is very slow in the dark and much faster in the light. Well, this is partly because rods are very slow and cones are much quicker, but it's also because within the rods or within the cones, these photoreceptors themselves have a time resolution which is speeded up by light adaptation. So those are the two characteristics of adaptation. When you are light adapted, you are less sensitive, of course, because many, many of the molecules in this chain have been inactivated, so you're less sensitive, but you also respond much more quickly. And this, of course, is an evolutionary advantage. It's good to respond more quickly because in a more quickly responding state, you're better able to avoid predators. And I think this has shaped a lot of our evolution throughout the years. You're also, of course, if you're playing tennis, you're much better able to respond, which is why, as the afternoon goes on, tennis matches are cancelled when the light level falls below a certain level. The players can no longer react quickly enough to hit the ball properly. Well, just to pursue this idea of adaptation to somatosensory receptors, you remember that I mentioned some time ago that Meissner's corpuscle responds to low-frequency vibrations. Meissner's corpuscle responds to low-frequency vibrations. Pacinian corpuscles respond to high-frequency vibrations. Then I mentioned these other two receptors, Merkel's disc and Ruffini's ending. These are not really vibration sensors. These respond much better to static changes in pressure. So if we're detecting steady pressure, we'll be doing this with these two receptors, which adapt very slowly. So this property of rapid adaptation, we've got two rapidly adapting receptors and two slowly adapting receptors. This sort of separation into rapidly adapting and slowly adapting is present pretty well throughout the nervous system. It's also present in the visual system, although in a somewhat more complicated way. So once again, rapid and slow adaptation. Well, rapid adaptation, just to tell you very quickly where this comes from, we've talked about the need for adaptation in the visual system. In the somatosensory system, once again, it has to do it, but it achieves it in a completely different way. Pacinian corpuscles are an example of rapid adaptation. The way it works, it's actually nothing to do with the nerve fiber at all. Around about 40 years ago, a very clever young scientist called Lowenstein did some very delicate experiments in which he was able to strip away the outer layers of the Pacinian corpuscle. And he found that when he'd stripped away, so this is the same one here, but with the outer layers dissected off, if he was able to do that very carefully so that he didn't damage the nerve underneath, then he found that in response to a stimulus, there was only slow adaptation, whereas, of course, the Pacinian corpuscle itself responds with very rapid adaptation. And he originated the theory that rapid adaptation in this particular case occurs not with the biochemical cascade of the sort that I talked about in photoreceptors, but instead occurs with mechanical structures which are wrapped around the axon. And the way it works is that these mechanical structures can be distorted. So the first pressure distorts the superficial layers, and it also distorts the nerve axon underneath. But because these layers are springy, the inner ones spring back and remove the pressure on the axon. And then when you take away the stimulus, there's a kind of bounce back phenomenon where the outer ones spring back and lead to a second distortion of the axon. So this means that we get, here you can see the effect, when the stimulus is applied, there's an action potential or two. When it's removed, there's an action potential or two, but there's no firing at all in response to a steady stimulus. So these receptors, they don't care at all about steady stimuli. All they're concerned with is change. They're detectors of change as a function of time. Well, I was going to talk about particular features of pain sensation, but I've been talking for an hour. I'll just show you some introductory slides. They're just kind of fun slides. I'm going to talk about pain in my next lecture, which will be this afternoon, but I just want to introduce some things about pain. Nobody likes pain, of course, but a life without pain, we may think that would be a happy life. Well, maybe it would be a happy life, but it certainly wouldn't be a very long one. There are some people who have a congenital insensitivity to pain, and this boy here is an example of one of these. He does seem to have a happy life, actually. He has a happy smile on his face. But you can see his life is not very happy apart from that. He has just absent-mindedly eaten off the ends of his fingers. This caused him no pain at all. You can see also that he's knelt on something sharp, which has caused a lesion on his knee here. If you look more closely, well, you don't need to look very closely, actually. You can see that he's not able to stand up by himself. He needs support. He needs someone to hold him. The reason for this is that his knees are very swollen, very expanded. If you and I are standing in one position for too long, our knee becomes uncomfortable. So without thinking about it, we just move like that. He doesn't do this. He will stand in one position for far too long, so his joints become extremely swollen and he's not able to stand. So life without pain is nasty and rather short as well. These people mostly die quite young, normally from traumatic accidents such as putting their foot in a fire or something like that. I just mentioned very quickly where this comes from. It's now the genetic basis of this fortunately very rare defect is now known. It's rare because these people normally don't survive to a sufficiently advanced age in order to pass their genes on to a subsequent generation. So pain is really very valuable from an evolutionary point of view. And the reason for this is that there's a defect in the TrkA receptor. The TrkA receptor, which binds nerve growth factor, of course. Nerve growth factor was discovered by Rita Levi-Montalcini, the great Italian scientist, now about 50 or 60 years ago. And NGF binds to the TrkA receptor and mediates the outgrowth of the nerve fibers which innervate the skin, so in of the pain-sensitive nerve fibers. So if this signaling pathway doesn't work well, either because the TrkA receptor has a defect or because NGF has a defect, then these outgrowing pain fibers which depend on this signaling in order to survive, NGF is a growth factor, a survival factor, developing fibers die because they don't detect NGF, and therefore there's a complete lack of the sensation of pain. Well, just to mention very quickly that pain is in some ways different from other sensations. We can fail to notice pain which in normal circumstances would be unbearable. This is a quote from actually 200 years ago from a famous battle, the Battle of Trafalgar, where Nelson defeated the Spanish, the French, and a few of their other allies. I don't think there were any Italians there, I'm happy to say, so I can put this up without making everybody cross. But one of the sailors wrote a letter home saying, This is written in the English of 200 years ago, which is a little bit different. This comes to tell you that I am alive and hearty except three fingers. That's not much, it might have been my head. How my fingers got overboard, I don't know, but off they are, and I never missed them until I wanted them. He didn't even notice that his fingers had been shot away until after the battle. So this shows that pain is a very variable quantity. I think if I put a bright light into your eyes, if you were conscious, under any circumstances you would notice that light. But this is an extreme pain which the sailor has not noticed because he was in the heat of battle. This is all to do with endogenous opioids, but I'm not going to talk about that much more. But secondly, pain can be felt in the absence of any stimulus. If you see a light in the absence of any light, then people would think you must be either crazy or a religious maniac of some sort. But pain, so light is not detected in the absence of light, but pain can certainly be detected in the absence of any stimulus. And this is another nice quote from actually about 400 years ago. It is a thing wondrous, strange and prodigious, which will scarce be credited unless by such as have seen with their own eyes, the patients who have many months after the cutting away of the leg grievously complain that they yet feel exceeding great pain of that leg so cut off. So I'll talk a little bit more about these things in my lecture this afternoon. Well, just to mention, of course, that there are specific pain receptors, just as there are photoreceptors, just as there are somatosensory receptors. This is something that was doubted for many years, but it was proved by some very nice experiments conducted in the 1960s by Ed Pearl, who is still alive and well and working in this field. And he recorded action potentials from single afferent nerve fibers, and he found that there were classes of nerve fibers which responded only to high threshold stimuli. High threshold stimuli, of course, are pain stimuli. Well, I think I won't go any further into this because I just about had my hour. I think it's time to stop, but I'll pick this topic up again this afternoon. So thank you very much. What do we do now, Antonio? Do we want questions or do we...
Yeah, I think there are questions, especially from the PhD students, but I think it's open to everybody. Also in Italian, I guess. Or in English.
Posso comprendere. Tutti gli studenti vogliono un caffè.
Okay, you can put questions beside also at the coffee break outside.
Okay. Thank you, Antonio.
10 minutes because we're a little bit late.
General.